This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
All over Europe and in the corridors of NATO, policymakers are discussing the implications for the continent of the Trump victory in the US presidential election. For 70 years, the alliance with America has been the foundation stone of European defence. The question now is whether that alliance can be maintained. If so, on what terms? And if not, what then? So how worried should we be with a new, but not quite new, man in the White House? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start by reminding ourselves of how things went last time Donald Trump was in office. Here with me is Heather Connolly, a senior advisor to the Board of Trustees of the think tank the German Marshall Fund. She's down the line from Washington, D.C. Heather Connolly, when Donald Trump first campaigned for president back in 2016, what at that point was he saying about NATO and European security, if anything?
Well, I think President-elect Trump has always been very consistent. You can even go back to the 1980s. He saw America's allies as taking advantage of a weak America, whether that was in trade, whether that was in defense, that the ally was getting the good deal and the United States was getting ripped off. And of course, presidents have been saying that for decades. You can go back to Dwight Eisenhower and asking European allies to pay 4% of their GDP on defense spending. But for the first time, Donald Trump made the explicit threat the United States would withdraw from NATO if NATO allies did not put their fair share in. So he has been consistent. And the fact that 23 NATO members out of 32 are spending 2% of their GDP on defense spending in some ways is a bit of a victory for him. But I think he, in the second term, he's going to push for much more.
During the course of his actual presidency, how did he get on with the European countries and the European members of NATO?
There was a variety of approaches by European leaders. We saw former German Chancellor Angela Merkel sort of chide the president on, you know, this is a values-based relationship. President Macron and others try to use persuasion, soft power, parades, dinners, things like that to soften him. Now leaders very quickly are using those tactics of getting into his inner circle as best they can and speak to what he wants them to do. Pay more, be more attentive. So I think NATO allies know how to manage the person as much as they can, but he's very unpredictable. So leaders could walk out of a meeting thinking they had an agreement and then getting a message out on social media that the president said absolutely the opposite or is doing the opposite. The unpredictability is always the greatest challenge.
But looking at the actual record during the period between 2016 and 2020, would you say that Donald Trump was as tough as his rhetoric suggested, or that actually he was more open to persuasion than the rhetoric might have led you to believe?
I think he did carry through on many of his threats, his rhetoric. Obviously, he threatened to withdraw from NATO. He did not withdraw from NATO, but the very threat of it came very close to really destroying NATO credibility. And at the very end of his first term, the withdrawal of some U.S. forces from Germany, I mean, that is, I think, an indication that a Trump administration is very willing to take action and follow through on that rhetoric.
I get confused about one thing, Heather, and that was to try and decide whether or not Donald Trump was essentially what you would call transactional. In other words, he tried to always get a better deal. And if he got a better deal, then he was quite happy to
have the old alliances, or whether he was fitting more and more into the isolationist tradition of America first and so on, which is also quite strong in America. Is he one or the other, or is he both?
He is both. But you're absolutely right to be confused, because I think it is his DNA, his nature to be transactional. That's the art of the deal, that if I have leverage over you, I can get a better deal. So which is why it's the Trump administration tends to bilateralize things, because that's where they can have the maximum pressure. And they use that maximum pressure to get what, to speak to the U.S. interest.
Heather, what do you mean by bilateralize?
So bilateralism is where the United States is going to work directly with one country and secure the best deal it can using our levers of influence, whether it's economic, well, it's our military presence, to get what we want. The multilateralism, going into organizations where multiple countries can form coalitions and perhaps soften America's views, that works to a bit of our disadvantage. So that bilateralism, again, is the transactionalism, to get the best deal, to put the most pressure on the country to do what we're interested in doing. The contradiction, though, in the isolationism, and certainly the, and I will hasten to say, ending U.S. involvement in wars is both prevalent on the left and the right in the United States. America is strongest when it has the largest amount of allies in this global alliance system that has been built over 75 years in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific, and elsewhere. That's our unique strength, our comparative advantage against our adversaries, Russia and China. And if we diminish that strength, it has costs. We're actually weaker. And I think that's going to be the very painful lesson I fear that the United States is going to have to learn. We've forgotten the power and the purpose of these alliances. And if we walk away from them or harm them to a point where they're not going to be helpful to U.S. interests, we're going to learn a very painful lesson.
Heather Connolly there, who'll be back later. Before that, let's recall what NATO actually is and how it came about. Back in 2018, Elizabeth Brewer, who is now at the Atlantic Council's Transatlantic Security Initiative, gave us a masterly précis. So we're repeating it.
So in 1948, there was a huge crisis in Berlin. The Soviets, who were occupying the eastern part of Germany, decided to block all access for any goods going into West Berlin. The Allies came together, the Brits and Americans primarily, and performed a stunning feat of delivering through the so-called Berlin airlift. It was a really impressive feat of solidarity with those West Berliners.
50,000 flights to Berlin, carrying 250,000 net metric tons of food and supplies for the people of the Western sector.
As a result of that, it dawned on the Allies that they really should become more serious about this thought of forming an alliance. The next year, so 1949, NATO was founded, the North Atlantic Treaty Association, essentially by the Allies who had stuck together during World War II and a few countries that had been occupied by Germany.
In the Pentagon in Washington, the North Atlantic Defense Committee, composed of the 12 Atlantic Pact nations, meets for the first time.
There is this famous saying, NATO was created to keep the Americans in, the Germans down, and the Russians out. And in fact, that's really how NATO was founded. Now, it had three official purposes, which was to deter Soviet expansionism, so to keep the Russians out, forbidding the revival of nationalist militarism in Europe, which I think is essentially saying keep the Germans down, and to keep a strong North American presence on our continent, so keep the Americans in. And that's exactly what happened. Now, so in 1963, there was a seminal moment in NATO history, the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Americans discovered that the Soviets had put missiles on Cuba, which is very close to the US, and it drove home the point that NATO territory, in this case the US, was not safe from Soviet aggression. NATO needed a centralized and strong military infrastructure and, of course, regular exercises. Large numbers of American soldiers and other NATO soldiers based in Germany, they constantly exercised together day and night. I was speaking to a British former officer the other day. He said, "We knew the name of every animal in the forest. That's how well prepared they were."
And one engineer has literally started hammering into the Berlin Wall, making a first incision.
On the 9th of November 1989, the Berlin Wall collapsed. And that set in motion a hugely important set of events. And eventually it resulted in the Soviet Union itself collapsing in 1991.
Good evening. 11 Soviet republics agreed to form a new Commonwealth of Independent States today and consigned the Soviet Union to history.
So now NATO had an identity crisis. So what do you do if you're a successful alliance and, in fact, you're so successful that you don't have any enemies anymore? But NATO remained in existence, and that then later proved a good thing when conflicts emerged in Europe again. Nobody realized that a country like Yugoslavia could fall apart so disastrously that it would cause wars, but that's what happened. And so it wasn't NATO territory, but after a while, NATO was called upon to intervene with military means by bombing and keeping the peace. Those two Balkan missions also helped NATO redefine what it was about, because this was not about territorial defense. It was just about maintaining stability in Europe, even in a sort of farther corner of Europe. And that then helped NATO, I think, also prepare for the new missions that came along with Afghanistan.
Today, we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center.
9/11 is a key moment in NATO history. It's not a traditional military attack, clearly. It's a terrorist attack. But NATO has something called Article 5, which means that when one ally is attacked, all the other allies come together to respond to that attack. It's quite interesting, I think, when Donald Trump talks about the lacking solidarity within NATO and how European allies don't pull their weight, that in fact the only conflict where NATO has invoked Article 5 is really Afghanistan, and a number of NATO allies really came to the aid of the United States. Today, NATO is back in what one might call territorial defense mode again, and that really dates back to 2014 with Russia's annexation of Crimea and the conflict in East Ukraine, when it dawned on the rest of Europe that really land warfare is not over, and in fact, it could affect any member state or any other European country, and we are all woefully underprepared for such a situation.
Elizabeth Brough in 2018, who now joins me in 2024, alongside the returning Heather Connolly and Shashank Joshi, defence editor of The Economist, to talk about where Europe goes from here. Now, since Elizabeth's explainer was recorded, Russia launched an invasion of Ukraine, pushing the issue of defence up the agendas of many European countries, and Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. So, Shashank Joshi, to what degree did the Russian invasion of Ukraine change the perception of European members of NATO about the nature of the threat to them?
It changed it very substantially, even more so than Russia's first invasion in 2014. We saw more countries meeting the alliance's target of spending 2% of GDP on defence. In Germany, we saw what the country calls a Zeitenwende, or a turning point, which will see Germany become the biggest military power in Europe, if it isn't already, exceeding France and the United Kingdom. We saw forces rush to the east of Europe, additional forces, and more battle groups deploy not just in the Baltic states, but also in countries like Romania and Bulgaria. And we saw significantly heightened activity in terms of NATO planning, because it may surprise, David, your listeners to know that NATO did not have full-fledged formal plans for the defense of the alliance after the Cold War. And this is clearly the most significant revival of NATO since its inception, since its founding at the beginning of the Cold War.
Just to clarify your last point, are you saying that up until the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there wasn't any kind of NATO plans to what to do if the Russians invaded an Article 5 member?
There were some plans, but there was no comprehensive regional plan that set out in great detail precisely which unit would go where, allowing those battalions and brigades and divisions to learn about their area of responsibility. There are now what the alliance calls 360-degree plans that cover scenarios all the way in the north, the high north up in the Arctic, the central front, so the Poland, the Baltic states, Central Eastern Europe, and also the south and southeast, so the Mediterranean, which includes not just threats from Russia, but also terrorist states and other kinds of challenges to the alliance.
Shashank Joshi, what do European countries think the actual threat is to them? How do they assess it?
I think the threat is low at the moment because Russia is enmeshed in this massive war in Ukraine in which they've lost more than 700,000 men dead and wounded, in which they continue to face ongoing fighting day to day. But the fact is, Russia spends 8% of its GDP on defense. Its war economy has revved up far more quickly and more decisively than that of Europe and the United States. And the question is, what does a reconstituted Russia look like? Not over 10 or 15 years, as perhaps was originally thought at the beginning of this campaign, but in 4 or 5 years. If you combine that with all the other things happening in the world, that is, President Trump, the prospect of America being sucked into wars in the Middle East, a nuclear Iran, conflict over Taiwan or in the South China Sea, then that concatenation of events, I think, results in a threat picture that could be quite acute, quite serious, certainly in a far shorter period of time than many of us thought just a few short years ago.
Elizabeth Brough, Shashank mentioned there the increase in defence spending. Can you just take us through who has done what in terms of increasing defence expenditure, and maybe also, if some people haven't done anything, who they are?
Poland, I think, is the perfect pupil here, has exceeded every expectation and is approaching almost 5% of GDP. Extraordinary figures that were rare even during the Cold War. But Poland is under no illusions about the threat facing it and its allies, and is committed to significant armed forces. In fact, so significant that it's now one of the largest militaries in Europe, which is no mean feat considering there are several countries that are larger than Poland. And then there are other countries like Sweden that under the new government has made a quantum leap when it comes to defence spending.
What about countries like Spain and Italy?
They will just never perceive the threat in the same way. But what is changing for them is that Russia is obviously becoming more active in Africa through the Wagner Group and indeed through various parts of its government. And what we're seeing is that Russia can try to deliberately destabilize various African countries so as to pose a threat and trouble for Europe. I think it's clear that Russia is up to no good in these various African countries, and that spells trouble for countries like Italy and Spain.
Heather Connolly, is there any perception, because the story that we're hearing here is not one of outright delinquency by European states, but is some kind of progress. Is there any perception, do you think, in the Trump camp that there has actually been progress of this sort?
But there's some recognition, and I think President-elect Trump takes the credit for the boost of 23 out of the 32 NATO members that have reached that 2%. I think the challenge is the goalposts have already moved, and I think you'll see the 2% now being the 3%. Actually, increasing defense spending here is going to be a really challenging topic because on the one hand, there is going to have to be measurable increases, but there's not consistency within, I think, a future Trump cabinet. You have Elon Musk saying defense spending has to be cut. So this question of defense spending is significant. And as Shashank mentioned, those regional defense plans, which was such a significant move in 2023 for NATO, now it's time to implement those. And this is where the capabilities and the military shortages are not going to be able to be hidden.
Elizabeth Brough, you wanted to come in.
Yes, I think one important aspect to remember is that the spending is just the beginning of becoming stronger militarily. Because defense spending has been quite low for some time in many countries, it will take time for defense manufacturers to ramp up production. And where are the factory workers who know how to make all these complicated weapons? They don't exist. The factory workers that we need, they have to possess very specific skills, and we don't have enough of them because we consider them dispensable at one point. Well, we need submarine welders now, and they don't exist.
Shashank Joshi, this is a really important point, it seems to me, because you have two things going on here. One is the kind of the headline figure. Even if you have the headline figure, can this translate actually into significant extra defence capacity in the relatively short term?
Well, that's absolutely right. And let me give you an example. Your listeners will know about the NATO target of 2% of GDP on defence. We talk about it a lot these days. What they might not know is that there is an additional target that NATO sets, and it is also that allies must meet a certain burden for investing a certain amount in defence equipment. The reason for that is we don't want allies, as some have done, and I'm looking here at some southern European countries, I'm looking at you, Greece, pumped huge amounts into things like pensions, which doesn't buy you combat capability.
Let me understand you. Greece has increased its defence expenditure by giving its military forces higher pensions.
This was a historic issue. I mustn't be unfair to Greece. Historically, countries like Greece often had heightened defence budgets because of really expenditure weighted towards labour and pensions and salaries. But that target of saying you must spend 20% of your defence spending on major equipment, not just on personnel, not just on salaries, not just on overhead in your defence ministries, that is exactly intended to get combat capability out. Even then, I'll say, if you look at a country like Poland, I think Elizabeth mentioned it, it's done fantastically well on spending huge amounts on rocket launchers, tanks, missiles, real hard combat capability. But even then, that's not enough, David, because you look at Poland, they've got long-range rockets. They haven't always got the sensors, the drones, the satellites capable of finding targets for those rockets. So remember, combat capability is very complex. It isn't just spending. It isn't even just equipment. Sometimes it's a package of capabilities that really require lots of complicated, varied things that countries often don't invest in.
And just a quick one on this, since we're a little bit kind of parochial, where would Britain at the moment stand in relation to both the spending and in terms of the 20% on equipment?
We do pretty well on spending. We're above 2%. We're obviously having a national debate on the timeline for which we should hit 2.5%, whether it should be in this parliament, as I suspect it will be, or whether it will be pushed later. And that's better than most NATO countries. However, when it comes to capability, and particularly, David, when it comes to the delta between what we have promised NATO to meet those regional plans I mentioned in our role in them and where we are, I'm afraid to say we are bottom of the pack. I think we're actually even lower than Canada, which is pretty dire.
So why are we so far away from what we promised?
Well, lots of reasons. We've given away lots of stuff to Ukraine. We've given away pretty much all of our artillery pieces. And in modern warfare, it's clear from Ukraine, David, artillery firepower makes a big difference. We've been hollowed out. We spent a long time fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, building a force for those sorts of things. We didn't always invest in capabilities that we didn't need in that era, things like air defenses. But we now see from Ukraine how absolutely vital those sorts of capabilities are, and everyone is now scrambling to buy those sorts of things.
Elizabeth, at one level, you could say, well, look, Russia's got a smaller economy than Germany and France and so on, and then surely these countries can, between them, spend enough in the right way to overcome what Russia can put into the field eventually. Is that actually true?
The first thing that needs to happen is that we have to have an open dialogue in our Western countries about the threats facing our countries. Because at the moment, what is happening is that defense types sit in various conferences and say, oh, we have to spend 2%. That is not reaching the general public. And then the politicians who dare to make the case for 2% to their voters are not exactly rewarded by those voters, because voters see what is needed around them. It's not fun for any politician to be open with the public about the threats that face the country, but we need a lot more of that.
Heather Connolly, this goes right to the heart of the question I asked you very close to the beginning of the programme, which was about transactionalism versus isolationism, which is essentially, if you tell a group of people that the price of being involved in defence in a big way is a significant amount of expenditure that they might prefer to spend elsewhere, are they actually going to be up for it?
Yeah, I mean, this really brings what Elizabeth's saying about public opinion. In democracies, you have to convince the public that this is important to spend on. The challenge we face here with NATO is the erosion of credibility of the United States. You have, one president that obviously President Biden, strong transatlanticist, believing in the alliance. The next president, potentially suggesting that the United States should withdraw from that alliance. It's very difficult for these long-term institutional building relationships to sustain that huge swing back and forth.
Elizabeth Broad, if America's not going to be a reliable partner in NATO, because simply for various reasons, for whichever reasons it is, what other ways do the Europeans have of organising their collective defence? I mean, is there such a possibility?
The success of NATO has been that it seems such an obvious part of the defence of Europe, clearly, that we can't think of anything outside NATO. Now, just as after the Second World War, leaders then had to think about how do we organise the defence of Europe, as it became clear that there was going to be a Cold War, and they came up with this thing called NATO. And so what can we think about now? Well, there are already various little groups that exist essentially orbiting around NATO. Now is the opportunity to strengthen them. The Joint Expeditionary Force, which is something that the UK de facto leads, there are 9 other countries are members of it, all in Northern Europe, like-minded countries, I feel strongly about national defence. Group like this already exists and it doesn't really have a clear mission or purpose at the moment.
Shashank Joshi.
I think European countries need to decide, are they building up their capability to induce America to stay, to show that they're serious about their defence and to shore up the transatlantic partnership? Or are they doing it to hedge against American withdrawal, to replace America? And it's tempting to say you can do both at the same time, that spending more, building up capabilities, building up what is sometimes called the European pillar of NATO does both jobs. I'm not convinced it does. If you are worried about America leaving NATO, there are very specific things, there are very specific gaps you need to fill. At the basic level, certain enabling capabilities. Air defence is one that I mentioned earlier, but also air-to-air refueling, suppression of enemy air defence capabilities. But also, most importantly, and this is really neglected most of the time, staff officers, military officers who can run headquarters, not just at small levels like battalions and brigades, but at senior levels, at divisions and corps. Right now, only a small number of countries in NATO, that's predominantly America, Britain, France, Germany, Finland, maybe a couple of others, provide serious bulk in running those big formations. If America's gone, Europe has to invest in those. And there's no getting around that. So there's a choice to be made.
And that choice has significant resource implications.
Massive. So if you take those regional defence plans for NATO that I mentioned earlier, in order to make those credible now, with America involved in Europe fully, most officials will tell you the internal estimates suggest you need to spend close to 3% of GDP on defence across the board. And of course, that really comes down to the big countries meeting those targets. If America is gone, then the figures look something a bit closer to spending upwards of 4%, somewhere between 4 and 5% of GDP on defence. By the way, that's not insane. We were spending that level at times during the Cold War. But of course, amongst other priorities, health, education, ageing societies, it's a much bigger ask. But that is what the financial requirements would be.
Shashank Joshi, thank you. We have to go, but my thanks to you, to Heather Connolly and Elizabeth Brough. And my conclusion, I think we've got to start explaining to voters why more of their money needs to go on the military and to start beefing up the defence industries. Now, just before we leave, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about why the water industry is in so much trouble, the one about what the budget told us about Britain's economy, and the one asking whether Germany is in trouble. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead Latham, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was Rod Farker. The editor is Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I wanted to speak to the souls of a million strangers.
This Cultural Life from BBC Radio 4.
I actually started crying.
Leading artistic figures reveal the influences that inspired their own creativity.
Wow.
I'm John Wilson, and we've had over 100 guests on the show so far, including Nile Rodgers and Zadie Smith.
I wanted to read everything without borders.
Andrew Scott.
If you miss out the sense of the absurd, then you're missing such a major part of what makes human beings wonderful.
Judi Dench, Paul McCartney, Whoopi Goldberg, Tracy Emin, Lily Allen.
I felt like I could be seen and affect people.
Listen to This Cultural Life on BBC Sounds.
It's like the beating of your heart. That's why I love it so much.
if there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.